look at a neuron in your brain and then imagine a cell in your liver.
Right. Two completely different worlds.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you put those two things under a microscope side by side, they look like entirely different alien species, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
They have completely different jobs, completely different physical shapes, different behaviors. I mean, the liver cell is basically this gritty chemical refinery, right? Just tirelessly filtering toxins and producing bile.
And then you have the neuron, which is this delicate branching wire that's firing electrical impulses to hold the memory of your favorite song.
Yeah, exactly. And yet there's this profound biological mystery sitting right underneath that microscope. They share the exact same DNA code.
Not just similar DNA, identical genomes.
Right, down to the very last letter. The blueprint of life is completely identical for both, yet the buildings they construct look completely different.
It's wild to think about.
It really is. And when that liver cell divides, it makes another liver cell, passing on all those differences without changing a single letter of that genetic code. So how is it that identical instructions produce such radically different forms of life?
It is the ultimate paradox of standard biology. Mm. And frankly, it is the thread that once you pull it, begins to unravel the entire story of life as we've been taught it.
Yeah, because we've all grown up with this deeply ingrained gene-centric model of the world.
We have. We're taught that DNA is the sole absolute architect of life, right?
Yeah.
The master blueprint that dictates every single biological reality.
Right.
But when you were forced to confront the reality of the liver cell and the neuron, that rigid model starts to show some pretty massive structural cracks.
Exactly. And that is exactly what we are diving into today. I want to welcome you joining us on this deep dive because we are exploring how evolution is about so much more than just genes.
It really is.
We are going to trace the way information is passed down from individual cells to animals to humans. And we'll discover how that flow of information might actually hold the key to the very origins of consciousness itself.
To do this, we are unpacking a truly groundbreaking 2026 paper by C.F. Dietz. It's titled The Grammar of Inheritance.
And it is a dense one, but so good.
Oh, it's brilliant. What is fascinating about this piece of work is how it functions as a bridge. It takes the pioneering evolutionary biology of Eva Jablonka, specifically her empirical work on what she calls the four dimensions of evolution, and fuses it with Dietz's own philosophical model, which is known as the closure framework.
So we have the hardcore biological data meeting a massive philosophical framework, but I want to warn you right now, if you think of evolution strictly as a random genetic lottery, you know, the standard story we all got in high school, prepare to have your reality shifted.
Completely shifted. We're looking at a total paradigm shift away from that one-dimensional view.
Okay, let's unpack this, because to understand why a paradigm shift is even necessary, we have to look at what we're actually shifting away from, right?
Right. In biology, the dominant paradigm is called the modern synthesis. It really took hold in the early 20th century.
This is basically marrying Darwin with Mendel, right?
Exactly. It married Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection with Gregor Mendel's work on genetics. And the core dogma of the modern synthesis is very strict. It says that the only way meaningful heritable variation is passed down through generations is through random genetic mutation in the DNA sequence.
So it's a very bottom-up view.
Very. It views the organism as essentially a passive vehicle, you know, just a fleshy robot carrying genes around, waiting for a random mutation to occur, and just hoping the environment doesn't kill it before it reproduces.
Right. The genes dictate the organism survives or dies, and the winner's genes get passed on. But going back to our liver cell and our neuron, if the modern synthesis says DNA is the only thing that carries memory across generations, then how on earth does a liver cell remember it's a liver cell when it divides?
That is the big question.
I mean, if the DNA is identical, what exactly is the cell remembering?
This is where Eve Jablonka's work just kicks the door down. She focuses intensely on epigenetic inheritance.
Epigenetics, meaning like above genetics.
Exactly, above or on top of genetics. Jablonka points out that cells don't just inherit a raw string of DNA letters. They inherit an incredibly intricate physical pattern of gene activation. We often make the mistake of thinking about DNA as just a computer code, like abstract information.
Right, just a sequence of ones and zeros.
But DNA is a physical molecule. Mm-hmm. It is a three-dimensional structure tightly spooled up inside the nucleus of a cell.
Okay, so if DNA is physical, how does epigenetics actually work on it? What is physically happening to turn a liver cell into a liver cell without changing the letters?
It comes down to physical barriers and chemical modifications. So, for example, a process called methylation. This is where tiny chemical tags made of carbon and hydrogen atoms physically attach themselves to specific parts of the DNA strand.
Oh, like little molecular clamps.
Precisely. Imagine the cellular machinery that reads the DNA as a little train moving along a track. When the DNA is heavily methylated, those chemical tags act like physical roadblocks on the track.
So the train literally can't get past.
Right. The reading machinery physically cannot get past them to read that specific gene. So that gene is effectively turned off or silenced.
Mm-hmm.
Alternatively, DNA is wrapped tightly around proteins called histones. If the histones wind the DNA up incredibly tightly, the genes are hidden and can't be read. If they loosen up, the genes are exposed and can be expressed.
That's amazing. If I'm trying to picture this abstract concept, imagine the identical genome in every cell is a massive, sprawling public library.
Okay, I like this analogy.
Every single cell in your body has the exact same collection of physical books. The liver cell's library had the exact same million books as the neuron's library. But if the DNA is the physical books on the shelves, epigenetics is the librarian.
Oh, that's perfect. So how does the librarian treat the two spaces differently?
Well, in the liver cell, the librarian walks in, goes to the massive section of books dedicated to building electrical synapses, and just wraps the entire bookshelf in heavy chains and padlocks.
Just completely seals them off.
Right. They throw away the key. Those synapse books are still physically sitting there in the building, but they are absolutely inaccessible. You just can't read them. Meanwhile, the librarian takes neon sticky notes, highlighters, and reading lamps, and sets up all the books about filtering toxins wide open on the main reading tables.
And in the neuron, a completely different librarian does the exact reverse.
Yeah.
They padlock the toxin filtering books and highlight the synapse books.
Yes.
The critical thing here is that the physical collection of books, the DNA sequence, never changed.
Yeah.
But the access to the books was radically altered.
Exactly. The librarian's organizational system is the epigenetic marks.
And here is where it becomes evolutionary. Jablonka and Dietz emphasize that the cell actually remembers this librarian's organizational system across many, many cell divisions.
Wait, really? It copies the sticky notes?
Yes. When that liver cell divides into two new liver cells, it doesn't just photocopy the books. It meticulously copies the exact arrangement of the chains, the padlocks, the sticky notes, and the open pages. The memory of the cell is not stored in the text of the DNA. It is stored in the structural organizational state of the chromatin.
Which completely changes the game. I mean, heredity passing down traits from parent to offspring isn't just a genetic process anymore.
That is the pivotal realization. Jablonka recognized that if individual cells can inherit non-genetic information, then whole complex organisms can too.
Right.
And if organisms can pass non-genetic information to their offspring, it means populations can adapt and change across generations through mechanisms that completely bypass random DNA mutation.
Evolution is no longer a single-lane dirt road of just genetic mutation.
No, it's a multi-lane highway. And Jablonka mapped out this highway, detailing what she calls the four dimensions of evolution. We have genetic, epigenetic, behavioral, and symbolic.
Okay, let's lay these out because we need to understand the distinct flavor of each one. So the first dimension is the genetic system. This is the baseline, the one we are all familiar with. DNA sequences being copied, occasionally mutating by pure chance, and being passed on.
Right. And the defining characteristic of the genetic dimension is its extreme stability and its extreme slowness. Because it relies purely on random, accidental mutations, and then waiting to see if those mutations actually help the organism survive, it takes thousands or millions of generations to produce significant adaptive change.
Right. It is the ultra-long game of evolution.
Exactly.
But the environment doesn't always give you a million years to adapt. I mean, sometimes an ice age hits or a new predator shows up out of nowhere.
Exactly. And that is why the second dimension, the epigenetic system, is so crucial. Operating at the cellular level, epigenetics introduces speed in plasticity. We talked about methylation and histones, but the evolutionary kicker is that these epigenetic changes aren't always random. They could be directly triggered by environmental signals.
Wait, hold on. The environment can directly talk to the epigenetics.
Yes. There are well-documented cases in biology where a parent organism experiences severe stress, say a famine or extreme temperature shifts. And this environmental stress triggers changes in their epigenetic markers.
Oh.
And some of those specific epigenetic markers, those chemical padlocks, can actually be passed down to their offspring, effectively pre-adapting the offspring's metabolism for a world with scarce food. And this happens without waiting for a random genetic mutation to occur.
So the environment is actively tweaking the librarian's sticky notes. That is wild. But even epigenetics has a limit, right? I mean, it can change how a cell processes sugar, but it can't teach an animal how to hunt a new type of prey.
Precisely. Epigenetics is confined to the cellular and physiological level. When life needed to adapt to complex macro-level problems in real time, it had to invent an entirely new system. This brings us to Jablonka's third dimension, the behavioral system.
The level of the whole organism. And the text provides this incredible historical example that perfectly illustrates this. It talks about a population of titmice, these small birds in the UK, that figured out how to open the foil caps on glass milk bottles delivered to people's doorsteps in the early 20th century.
The milk bottle birds. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most famous examples of behavioral inheritance.
It's so cool. So one clever bird is hopping around a porch, pecks at the shiny silver foil on a milk bottle, and discovers rich, high-calorie cream right at the top.
Right. A total gold mine.
Yeah. And that original bird didn't have a magical, random genetic mutation that created a peck-the-foil instinct. It just used its basic intelligence and stumbled onto a solution. But the magic happens next. Other birds in the neighborhood see this happening. They watch, they observe, and they imitate. Within a surprisingly short amount of time, this highly specific behavior sweeps through the entire population. They pass this incredibly valuable survival knowledge down to the next generation entirely through observation and social learning.
They are completely bypassing the genetic code. The behavioral system transmits information horizontally across a population, not just vertically from parent to child. It is exponentially faster than the epigenetic system, allowing an entire population to respond to a new environmental opportunity like human milk delivery almost instantly.
Okay, I have to jump in here and play devil's advocate for a second because my high school biology teacher is screaming in my head right now.
Let's hear it.
If a bird learns to open a milk bottle, that's great. It's a neat cultural trick. But if the milk bottles suddenly disappear tomorrow, the birds will forget the trick in a generation. Their underlying DNA hasn't changed at all. So how does cultural mimicry actually count as biological evolution? Are we just talking about Lamarckism?
Lamarckism.
Yeah. You know, the old debunked theory that a giraffe stretches its neck to reach high leaves during its life and then somehow passes a longer neck to its baby. We laughed at that.
We did laugh at that. And that is the exact friction point, and it's a brilliant question. It brings us to the core mechanism Jablonka highlights, which completely separates this from simplistic Lamarckism. Mm. And that mechanism is bidirectionality.
Bidirectionality, okay.
We tend to think of these inheritance systems as parallel lanes on a highway that never intersect. Genes do their slow thing, behavior does its fast thing, and they never touch. But Jablonka shows they interact deeply in both directions.
Okay, but how does behavior reach down and touch the genes?
Think about the environment as a filter. Genes provide the raw material, the baseline biology. But when higher level systems like behavior emerge, they don't just passively exist in the environment. They actively modify the conditions of the environment. They change the filter itself.
I see. When the birds learn to open the bottles, they've actually changed their own world.
Exactly. By culturally adopting this behavior, they have suddenly opened up a massive, completely novel, calorie-dense food source. They have fundamentally altered the selection pressures acting on their own population.
Oh, wow.
Right. Now, the environment is rewarding entirely different traits. Before the milk bottles, maybe the fastest flyer survived best. But in the milk bottle environment, any bird that happens to have a random genetic predisposition for curiosity or slightly better beak dexterity or an innate ability to learn visual tasks faster is going to get more cream, survive longer, and reproduce more successfully.
So the behavior sets the stage. The culture discovers the gold mine, and then natural selection goes to work on the underlying genetics, favoring any genes that make mining that gold easier.
Yes.
The behavior leads, and the genetics are dragged along behind it.
Exactly. And just to round out Jablonka's framework before we look at the underlying structure,
yeah.
The fourth dimension she identifies is the symbolic system.
Right, the cultural level, which is uniquely dominant in humans. Language, mathematics, art, digital code.
Yes. We will dive deeply into the symbolic system later because it represents a massive, unprecedented evolutionary leap. But for now, the key distinction is that symbolic inheritance is not constrained by physical presence.
What do you mean?
Well, a bird can show another bird how to open a milk bottle, but it has to be physically standing next to a milk bottle to do it. Symbolic inheritance can encode information about the past, the distant future, and things that don't even physically exist.
Right, that's a huge difference. So Jablanka provided the empirical proof. She showed that these four systems, genetic, epigenetic, behavioral, and symbolic, exist, and she showed that they interact bidirectionally.
So she did.
But according to our source material, Jablanka's biology didn't necessarily explain why there are exactly four systems or what the underlying mathematical or structural logic is that forces them to stack on top of each other.
That is precisely where C.F. Dietz enters the picture. The source text brings in Dietz's closure framework to provide the structural scaffolding for Jablanka's biological observations. Dietz is asking a more fundamental question. He's asking, what is the actual architecture of reality that makes evolution behave this way?
Okay, so we're getting philosophical.
We are. And to grasp this, we have to understand what Dietz means by a closure regime.
Let's unpack that term, because closure usually implies finishing something, like getting closure after a bad breakup. But Dietz is using it in a very specific, systemic way.
In Dietz's framework, a closure regime is a system that stabilizes the specific type of content. It draws a boundary around a chaotic environment, establishes internal rules, and creates lawful relationships among its parts. Essentially, a closure regime is a machine for creating facts at a specific level of reality.
Okay, can you give me an example of a biological closure creating a fact?
Sure. Take the genetic system. The DNA, RNA, and the cellular reading machinery form a closure regime. They operate by a strict set of rules. The chaotic soup of molecules outside the cell is meaningless noise, but inside the genetic closure regime, a sequence of DNA letters constitutes a hard fact. It dictates a specific sequence of amino acids to build a protein.
Right.
The closure regime creates order out of chaos by drawing a boundary and saying, inside this boundary, these rules apply.
Okay, that makes sense. A system that creates order. But here is the secret sauce of the whole paper, the concept that Dietz introduces that changes everything. The remainder.
What's fascinating here is that the remainder is everything. Dietz argues that every finite closure regime, by the very act of drawing a boundary and establishing rules, inevitably generates a remainder.
A remainder of what?
The remainder is the leftover potential. It is the vast, staggering space of possibilities that the closure regime simply cannot process, specify, or model within its own rigid rules.
It's the gap. It's the blind spot created by its own existence.
Yes. It is the inevitable gap between what a finite system can control and the infinite, inexhaustible complexity of the reality it exists in. And Dietz's brilliant realization is that Jablanka's four dimensions of evolution are not just a random list. They are a nested hierarchy of these closure regimes.
Oh, wow.
Each level exists specifically to exploit the remainder of the level beneath it.
They feed on the gaps. Let's trace this, because the text outlines what we could call a ladder of remainder. Let's start at the foundational level, the genetic closure. We said it creates facts about proteins, but what is its blind spot? What is the genetic remainder?
The genetic closure is incredibly stable, but it is static. Its remainder is the nearly infinite space of possible protein configurations, complex folding patterns, and real-time regulatory interactions that a static genome simply cannot specify in advance.
Because it can't predict the future.
Exactly. The DNA can give you the bricks, but it cannot dictate exactly how the cellular machinery should arrange those bricks in every single possible microenvironment the cell might encounter over its lifespan. It can't anticipate a sudden drop in oxygen or a spike in toxins. That inability to adapt in real time is its remainder.
So the genetic system leaves a massive gap of unmanaged potential. Enter the second dimension, the epigenetic closure.
Exactly. The epigenetic closure regime uses that massive genetic remainder as its raw resource. It takes the genome's vast, unorganized potential and deploys it in highly specific, context-dependent ways.
Like the librarian.
Right. The epigenetic system says, I know the genes can't adapt to this sudden lack of oxygen, but I can put a chemical padlock on the oxygen-burning genes and highlight the anaerobic ones. It manages the genetic remainder.
But the epigenetic system is also a finite closure, so it must generate its own remainder.
It does. Epigenetics is phenomenal at managing the internal state of the cell. But its remainder is macro interaction with the outside world. An epigenetic change can alter how a cell processes a nutrient. But an epigenetic change cannot help a mouse figure out how to navigate a maze or run away from a newly introduced predator.
Because it's stuck inside the cell.
Exactly. The epigenetic system is blind to macro behavior. That limitation is its remainder.
Which gives birth to the third dimension, the behavioral closure. The organism-level behavioral system stepped in and uses the epigenetic remainder, that cellular plasticity, to learn in real time, to move, to react, to socialize, to open milk bottles.
You see how they stack.
Huh.
But even the behavioral closure, as powerful as it is, generates a remainder. A bird can learn a brilliant behavioral solution from its environment. It can even show the bird next to it. But it cannot fully encode the abstraction of that behavior.
Yeah, that makes sense.
It cannot transmit the idea of a milk bottle to a bird on another continent, or to a bird that will be born 10 years after the milk bottles are gone. It is trapped in the physical present.
Which finally necessitates the symbolic closure, the cultural level, language, which feeds on the behavioral remainder. To make this abstract, nested hierarchy really concrete, imagine we're building a massive multinational corporation.
Let's build it.
Okay, so the genetic closure is the foundational charter of the company, written by the board of directors. They write the core mission statement, they set up the basic corporate bylaws, the fundamental blueprints.
Sounds solid.
But the board of directors sitting in a room cannot possibly micromanage every single daily interaction of every employee across the globe. That rigid long-term focus is their strength, but their inability to manage the day-to-day chaos is their remainder.
So what does the corporation do with that remainder?
They create a new level. They hire middle management. That's the epigenetic closure. Middle management takes the board's rigid directives and adapts them to specific daily situations. They interpret the rules, creating flexible procedures based on the immediate environment of their specific branch.
Nope.
But middle management is stuck in the office. They can't physically build the products or shake hands with every customer. That physical disconnect is their remainder.
Which requires the next level of closure.
Exactly, the frontline workers. The behavioral closure. The salespeople, the factory workers, the engineers, they are out in the field operating in real time, learning on the fly, reading the customer's body language, improvising solutions.
But they have a limitation too.
They do, because even the brilliant frontline workers have a gap. If a salesperson in Tokyo invents an incredible new sales pitch, they can't instantly transfer that abstract idea into the minds of 1,000 salespeople in London just by having them watch.
The behavior is trapped in Tokyo.
Right. And that final gap requires the highest level of organization, the symbolic closure, the executive communication suite, the corporate intranet, language, memos. The symbolic system takes the raw, successful behavior of that one employee in Tokyo, encodes it into abstract language, and disseminates it globally, training employees who haven't even been hired yet. Each level exists only because the level beneath it left a gap that needed filling.
That is a remarkably precise analogy. Dietz would call that a nested closure hierarchy. The lower levels set the boundary conditions, and the higher levels manage the chaotic dynamics that the lower levels can't handle.
It's such a beautiful system.
It is.
Yeah.
And understanding the stacking is absolutely critical because it explains a biological phenomenon that radically redefines our place in nature. We touched on it with the milk bottle birds,
yeah,
but we need to examine it through Dietz's structural lens. The concept is genetic assimilation.
Yes, genetic assimilation. The text defines this as supersession across levels. We talked about how behavior drags genetics along, but how does that actually work mechanically? How does a habit turn into an instinct?
Well, it requires us to abandon the idea that organisms are passive. Through the closure framework, we see that life actively steers its own evolution by establishing higher-level stability. Let's look at a classic evolutionary problem. Imagine an environment slowly becoming colder.
Okay.
The modern synthesis is the population just suffers and dies off until, purely by chance, a random genetic mutation for thicker fur appears. The organism is just a passive victim of a dice roll.
Right, just waiting around to be saved by a typo in the DNA.
But genetic assimilation shows that organisms are active agents. When the temperature drops, the animals don't just wait to die. They use their behavioral closure. They actively seek shelter. They learn to huddle together for warmth. They might migrate to the sunny side of the valley. They establish a stable behavioral pattern to solve the problem.
So they create a behavioral buffer against the environment.
Precisely. And by creating that stable behavioral buffer, they change the selection pressures. Now, the environment isn't strictly selecting for thick fur. It is selecting for anything that supports the behavior of huddling or seeking shelter.
That makes total sense.
Right. So if an animal happens to have a slight genetic variation that makes its metabolism run a tiny bit hotter when it huddles, or maybe a neural tweak that makes it more social so it huddles more effectively, that gene is highly selected for.
I see. The behavior holds the line, giving the genes time to catch up.
Exactly. Over many generations, the genetic closure is forced to update in order to better support the stable pattern established by the behavioral closure. Eventually, what started as a desperate, hard-won, learned behavior-seeking shelter becomes structurally baked into the genetics as an innate instinct. The genetic closure supersedes in response to the behavioral closure.
So what does this all mean? Life isn't just responding to evolution. Life is doing evolution. It's an inside job. I have another analogy for this to really lock in the causality.
Was there it?
Imagine a massive, newly built city park. It's a huge square of green grass, and the city planners, who represent the genetic level, only put concrete sidewalks around the outer edges. They didn't put a path through the middle.
Okay, classic urban planning mistake.
Right. But the citizens, who represent the behavioral level, realize that walking around the edges takes too long. They want to cut straight across the grass to get to the train station. So one person walks across the grass, then 10, then 100. Over a few months, the collective behavior of the citizens wears away the grass and creates a highly visible, packed dirt trail right through the middle of the park. In urban planning, they actually call this a desire path.
I love that term, a desire path.
So the behavioral level has created this stable desire path. It solved the environmental problem. Mm. Eventually, the city planners, the genes, look at an aerial view of the park. They see this massive dirt path that everyone is actively using, and they say, well, the people have spoken. We better pour concrete over that.
Naturally.
So the planners come in and pave a permanent structural concrete sidewalk right over the dirt path. That paving process is genetic assimilation. The behavior forged the path in real time, and the genes came in generations later to make it permanent structural concrete.
The concrete supersedes the dirt. That is a perfect visualization. The behavior leads, the genes solidify. I want to stress that this is not just some fringe philosophical theory. The text explicitly connects this mechanism to the broader, cutting-edge scientific landscape. It mentions Dennis Noble's work on biological relativity and Carl Friston's active inference.
I saw those names in the text, and they sound incredibly dense. Let's start with Dennis Noble. What does biological relativity actually mean in this context?
Dennis Noble is a pioneering systems biologist, and biological relativity is essentially a massive pushback against the idea that DNA is the master molecule. Noble argues mathematically that there is absolutely no privileged level of causation in biological systems.
Meaning there's no single boss.
Exactly. The modern synthesis argues for upward causation. You know, genes cause cells cause organs cause behavior. It's a one-way street from the bottom up. But Noble proved that causation flows downwards just as powerfully. The whole organism, through its behavior and its interaction with the environment, exerts downward causation on its own cellular and genetic networks, dictating which genes are expressed and ultimately which are selected. The genome is an organ of the cell, not its dictator.
So the top floor of the building is telling the basement what to do. And how does Carl Friston fit into this? He's a neuroscientist, right?
Yes, and arguably one of the most cited neuroscientists alive. Friston formulated the free energy principle and active inference. It is a mathematical model of how biological systems sustain themselves. Friston argues that any living system must fundamentally minimize surprise.
Surprise, like a jump scare.
Not quite. In thermodynamics, surprise basically means entropy, disorder, or encountering a state you didn't predict. A fish taking a breath and finding air instead of water is experiencing massive biological surprise, which leads to death.
Ah, okay. That kind of surprise.
Right. So Friston argues that organisms don't just passively update their internal models to match the world. They use active inference to physically act upon the world to make the world match their internal models.
They force the environment to conform to their expectations to avoid dying of surprise.
Exactly. When an organism builds a nest, it is actively changing the physical environment to match its internal expectation of a safe, warm temperature. Dietz points out that Noble's downward causation, Friston's active inference, and Jablonka's genetic assimilation are all pointing at the exact same systemic reality.
It's all connected.
It is the inescapable reality of nested closure regimes. Higher levels establish patterns to minimize surprise, and lower levels update to support them. It is not an accident. It is a structural necessity of life.
Which brings us to a massive, mind-bending evolutionary crossroads. We have this elegant system of nested levels. Lower levels leave a remainder, higher levels feed on that remainder, and then the higher levels pave the desire paths of the lower levels. It's an engine of increasing complexity.
It really is.
But what happens when this upward stacking of closures reaches a critical mass? Because the paper argues that this exact engine of remainder and closure is what triggered the single greatest leap in the history of biology, the emergence of actual felt consciousness.
This is where we transition from purely mechanical biology into the realm of subjective experience, drawing heavily on Jablonka's collaborative work with Simone Ginsberg. In their landmark book, The Evolution of the Sensitive Soul, they attempt to answer what I consider to be the most profound question in all of science. How did evolution cross the chasm from creating complex, non-experiencing biological robots to entities that actually possess a subjective inner life?
Right. Like, how do you go from a sunflower that mechanically tracks the sun across the sky to an animal that actually feels the warmth of the sun on its back? When did the lights turn on inside the house?
Jablonka and Ginsberg spent years searching for the evolutionary marker, the biological Rubicon, that indicates the presence of this sensitive soul. They were looking for the exact functional capability that demands consciousness to operate. And the marker they identified is a specific, highly advanced type of cognitive processing called unlimited associative learning, or UAL.
We need to define UAL extremely clearly, because my first thought is Pavlov's dog. You ring a bell, the dog gets food, eventually the dog drools when it hears the bell. Is UAL just complex drooling?
No, Pavlovian conditioning is incredibly limited. A simple organism, even a flatworm, might be able to associate a specific chemical gradient with a food source. But it is locked into that specific, rigid, one-to-one stimulus-response pairing. It's a closed loop. It can't generalize.
Okay, so it's very narrow.
Very. Unlimited associative learning is a completely different paradigm. It is the ability to form novel associations across any sensory domain in real time, over a lifetime.
So synthesizing sight, sound, smell, memory all at once?
All of it. An organism with UAL can encounter a completely brand new, highly complex, compound stimulus, say, a situation or a predator it has never ever encountered in its evolutionary history, and it can evaluate it. It can assign a motivational value to it, like this specific combination of sounds and smells in this particular location is dangerous.
Wow.
And then, crucially, it can use that new abstract assignment of value as the foundation for a second order of learning, building associations on top of associations, infinitely.
And the text points out a very specific, explosive moment in Earth's history when this UAL hardware came online.
Yes, the Cambrian explosion, roughly 540 million years ago. If you look at the fossil record, life before the Cambrian was mostly simple, slow-moving, or stationary organisms, sponges, jellyfish. Then suddenly, in an evolutionary blink of an eye, there is a massive diversification of complex animal life.
It's like biology went into overdrive.
We see the sudden appearance of intricate eyes, complex jointed appendages, armor plating, and the first true predators hunting highly mobile prey.
It was an absolute biological arms race.
And Jablonka and Ginsberg argue that this arms race wasn't triggered by a sudden change in oxygen or temperature. It was driven entirely by the emergence of unlimited associative learning in the nervous systems of early bilaterian animals. Once an animal possessed the cognitive flexibility to learn anything, it could adapt to any niche, outsmart, simpler organisms, and invent new ways of hunting. UAL was the engine of the Cambrian explosion.
Okay, I'm going to stop it right there because I'm struggling with a major logical leap here.
What's the leap?
I totally understand why UAL is the ultimate survival tool. If you can learn anything, you can survive anywhere. But you are claiming that UAL equals feeling. You are claiming it equals subjective consciousness. I don't buy it yet. Tell me how. I mean, we can program an AI neural network right now to do incredibly complex, limitless associative learning. It can associate millions of data points across domains. But we don't assume ChatGPT has a sensitive soul and feels something when it processes a prompt. Why does UAL equal subjective experience in biology?
That is the exact philosophical hurdle that trips up most theories of consciousness. And it is precisely where Deitz's closure framework saves the day. Jablonka found the functional threshold UAL, but she couldn't fully explain the structural reason why it crosses into feeling. Deitz provides the how and the why using our favorite concept, the remainder.
We are back to the gaps.
Always back to the gaps. Think about our flatworm with simple conditioning. It has a rigidly fixed cognitive boundary. It only knows the narrow chemical signals it has been genetically programmed to associate. As Deitz puts it, a simple system cannot learn about what it cannot associate. Its remainder, the vast, chaotic, unknown complexity of the universe, is entirely invisible to it. It doesn't know what it doesn't know.
It's a completely closed loop. It processes input like a calculator.
Exactly. A calculator doesn't feel the math. But an organism with unlimited associative learning is structurally different. Because its neural architecture is designed to form associations across any domain, it is the first biological system that can actually take its own cognitive boundary, the limits of its current internal model, and treat whatever lies beyond that boundary as a problem to be solved.
Wait, run that back. It takes its own boundary as a problem.
Yes. When an organism with UAL encounters a completely novel, complex stimulus, let's say our Cambrian creature, encounters a shadow it has never seen, accompanied by a vibration it has never felt, it doesn't have a pre-programmed instinct for it. It cannot just run a reflex program.
So what does it do?
It has to temporarily suspend its automatic reactions. To figure out what this novel thing is, the nervous system has to create a centralized global workspace, a unified field of attention to hold all these conflicting, novel sensory inputs together at the same time.
It has to hold the pieces of the puzzle in suspension.
Yes. If we connect this to the bigger picture, Dietz makes a critical distinction here between two concepts, capital C and lowercase c. Capital C is bare conscious presence, the fundamental raw condition of subjective experience. Lowercase c is consciousness with specific content, the actual image of the predator you are seeing, or the pain you were feeling. Dietz argues that the biological requirement to hold conflicting, unmodeled stimuli in a centralized workspace to evaluate them is the generation of capital C consciousness.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let me see if I can translate the mechanics of this, because this is the core of the whole deep dive. Dietz is saying that consciousness isn't just a byproduct of having billions of neurons wired together. It isn't just complex computing. Consciousness is the literal physical friction of encountering what you do not know.
The friction, yes.
The organism has an internal model of the world. Then it encounters reality, which is infinitely more complex than its model. The text calls this infinite reality M, the inexhaustible ground, the brute physical reality that escapes our models. So when the UAL organism encounters something from the inexhaustible ground that breaks its model, it has to hold the broken pieces in its cognitive workspace to learn from them. The effort of holding that unmodeled data, the tension of not knowing what to do next, the friction between the internal model and the inexhaustible reality, that tension is what we experience as feeling.
That is a phenomenal summary. To be conscious is to feel the friction of your own remainder. A simple machine or a narrow AI just processes inputs according to rules. If it gets an input outside its rules, it just throws an error code or crashes. It doesn't feel the error because it is perfectly closed.
Right.
But a UAL system is biologically mandated to be open-ended. It has to endure the tension of not knowing so that it can assign value and learn. That tension, that prolonged openness to the remainder, is the biological birth of subjective experience. The cognitive closure is finally sophisticated enough that its encounter with the unknown is felt rather than merely processed.
That is staggering. The idea that subjective consciousness, the sensitive soul, was born the exact moment a biological system became complex enough to recognize its own ignorance. It's poetic, but it's grounded in sheer neural mechanics.
It's incredible.
And once an organism can feel that gap, once it has a sensitive soul, the ultimate evolutionary step, the final dimension we have to cover, is finding a way to actually communicate about that gap.
Which brings us to the zenith of Jablonka's framework, symbolic inheritance. According to the text, this marks the transition from minimal consciousness, the sensitive soul, to what philosophers historically called the rational soul. This is the realm of humanity, and it represents a total phase transition in the history of life.
We touched on this earlier with the corporate executive analogy, the intranet spreading the memo. But the text suggests that language is fundamentally different from a bird mimicking a behavior. Why is language such a radical departure from everything that came before it?
It is a radical departure because language isn't just a louder, faster way to transmit behavioral tricks. Symbolic language allows a biological system for the first time in 4 billion years to encode the absent, the counterfactual, and the hypothetical.
Things that do not physically exist.
Exactly. Go back to our milk bottle birds. A bird can brilliantly show another bird how to open a bottle, but it has to do it right in front of them, physically pecking the bottle. The behavioral system requires the physical presence of the environment to function.
Because they can't talk.
Right. A bird cannot transmit the concept of a bottle to a bird that has never seen one. It cannot squawk, "Hey, listen to me. If you see a glass cylinder with a silver top tomorrow, there's food inside."
But with language, we are completely detached from the physical present. I mean, I can sit here in a studio and tell you a highly detailed story about a fire-breathing dragon. You can picture it perfectly in your mind. You can feel fear or excitement, even though a dragon has never existed in the physical world. I can warn you about a climate crisis that might happen 50 years from now.
Yes. In Dietz's structural terms, symbolic language is the open-ended closure. It is the only closure system in biological history that can explicitly, formally represent its own remainder.
Let's break that phrase down. Representing its own remainder. How does language do that?
It means language has the unique capacity to create actual positive categories for the things it does not know. A behavioral system can encounter a problem it can't solve, but it can only transmit its successes to the next generation. It can't pass down a memo saying, here's a list of things we couldn't figure out.
Oh, I see.
But the symbolic system can create words like unknown, impossible, mystery, or hypothetical. We can mark the exact boundary of our understanding and point directly at the darkness beyond it.
Humans transmit our failures and our mysteries constantly. That's what a textbook is. Here is what we know, and at the end of the chapter, here's the frontier of what we don't know yet.
Exactly. Language explicitly encodes the absence of knowledge as a definitive thing.
Yeah.
We can talk about what is not there. And that structural ability creates the possibility of deliberate, cumulative scientific inquiry. We can use the symbolic closure to actively pursue the very things the symbolic closure has acknowledged it does not yet understand.
That is just, it's incredibly profound when you step back and look at the context of what you and I are doing right now. The fact that you, listening to this deep dive, are tuning in, that you are inherently curious, that you ask questions, that you seek out dense subjects to learn about, that is not just a personality quirk.
No, it's not.
Your curiosity is a literal manifestation of this evolutionary architecture. Science, philosophy, this entire conversation, it is simply the symbolic closure deliberately exploring its own remainder.
That is exactly right. The pursuit of knowledge isn't just a hobby. It is the biological system fulfilling its structural mandate to push its boundary into the inexhaustible ground.
Mm.
It's the highest, most complex expression of the evolutionary grammar we've been tracing from the very beginning.
I love that so much. The idea that acknowledging our own ignorance, realizing the vast scale of what we don't know, isn't a flaw in human design. It is literally the highest, most advanced biological function on the planet. It is the pinnacle of 4 billion years of nested evolution.
It is deeply humbling, but also incredibly empowering. We are the system becoming aware of its own gaps.
Let me take a deep breath here, because we have covered a staggering amount of intellectual ground today. Let's trace the arc of this deep dive one last time. We started with a microscopic biological mystery, right? The liver cell and the neuron proving that the rigid, one-dimensional, gene-centric view of life was an incomplete illusion.
That was just the beginning.
Yeah. From there, we walked through Eva Jablonka's expanded playbook, the 4 dimensions of evolution, the slow genetic baseline, the speedy epigenetic sticky notes, the real-time behavioral desire paths, and the abstract symbolic power of language.
And we used C.F. Dietz's closure framework to reveal the hidden architecture beneath all of it. We saw how each dimension is a nested closure regime, feeding on the remainder, the leftover potential of the system beneath it.
So cool.
We explored Dennis Noble and Carl Friston, seeing how genetic assimilation proves that life is an active, downward-causing agent in its own evolution, not a passive victim.
And most incredibly, we discovered that consciousness itself, the sensitive soul, was born the exact moment biological systems developed unlimited associative learning, becoming complex enough to actually feel the friction of their own unknown. We learned that to be conscious is to feel the inexhaustible reality rubbing against your internal model.
We have traced the grammar of inheritance all the way from the molecular clamps on a DNA strand to the philosophy of the conscious rational mind.
Which brings us to the end of our journey today, but I want to leave you with one final, deeply provocative thought to mull over, something that builds on this entire framework but pushes it into the future.
If we fully accept the premise of Dietz's framework, that every single level of closure inevitably generates a remainder, a massive gap of unmodeled potential, and that this remainder eventually acts as the raw material to give birth to an entirely new, higher level of evolution, well, it raises a staggering question about our current moment in history.
What's the question?
Think about our global symbolic human culture right now. We are generating vast, unprecedented oceans of linguistic, cultural, and technological data. Artificial intelligence, global internet networks, server farms, storing exabytes of human thought. What is the remainder of that system? What is the new unmodeled gap that our global symbolic closure cannot handle?
What are we leaving behind?
Exactly. And if the 4 billion year history of biology is any guide, What wildly new, incomprehensible fifth dimension of evolution might that digital remainder be acting as the raw material for right this very moment? Are we currently the middle management for a new evolutionary closure that we can't even conceptualize yet?
Wow. Are we just the epigenetic layer for whatever comes next? That is a thought that is going to keep me staring at the ceiling tonight.
Me too.
The idea that the friction, the overwhelming data overload we feel as a society right now, might just be the literal growing pains of the next evolutionary leap. I want to warmly thank you for joining us on this incredibly dense, fascinating journey today. It has been an absolute privilege to unpack this framework with you. Keep exploring the edges of your own remainder. Don't be afraid of the friction of the unknown, and never stop looking for the profound mechanics hidden inside the everyday world.